Well, Life on Earth tried to show, to chart the development of animal life by devoting one programme and one chapter of the book to a particular group of animals. So there's one on fish, and there was one on amphibians, one on reptiles, one on birds, so on. What that couldn't do, though, was to show a way in which animals of different groups interacted with one another. So on the bird programme, you didn't see much about the insects that they fed on, for example. Neither could you see how human beings of all kinds, tribal as well as sophisticated, meshed into that pattern. So this new series aims to look at a group of environments, one per programme. So there's one on deserts and there's one on jungles, one on mountains and so on.
How did you chart your course? Because you really did go up and down and north and south, travel the world several times over, I think, but you went to the most extreme climates.
Yes. Well, a lot of the ecosystems or environments, whatever you wish to call them, chose themselves. I mean, those I listed, deserts, jungles, grasslands, coasts, are all fairly obvious. So is mountains and snow, though you could have done one on snow and one on mountains, but we chose to do the same in one. And actually, it turns out to be at just about 12, which is what you need.
For a series, right?
Yes.
Were you careful to not go from the desert 1 month to the North Pole the other, so as to not be exposed to extremes yourself?
Not really. What actually happened is that I wrote the entire series before we start, because with a kind of mosaic series like this, in which you may hop from continent to continent, from the Sahara to the Mojave, in the desert program, for example, you have to know exactly why you're going where and what you're going to say when you get there. So you have to write the whole thing first. And then, of course, so you suddenly find you've got to go to, let's say, South America, Brazil, for the rainforest. But also you know that you're going to have to go and do the Amazon for the river program and the mangroves at the mouth at Belém for the coastland program and the Andes for the mountain program, so that you actually tend to do it in those kind of territories.
How did you decide what kind of crew and equipment you were going to take with you? Most people like to travel light when they're hiking through the mountains, which you can't really do when you're doing a television series.
No, but you still have the same ambition. You still have the same to do it as economically. And I don't mean that in terms of money, because, you know, I mean, of course we all care about money, but that's not the critical factor. It is mobility and speed of getting around. You don't want to go and, if you can get in one Land Rover instead of two, that's better. And so we have an absolute minimum size crews. There's myself, a cameraman, an assistant cameraman, a sound recordist, and a director. So there's five of us. But in addition to that, because you were able to write the whole series before you start, you know you're going to want a shot of, what should we say, a scorpion hunting a spider, let us say. So you don't need me in that shot because I'm too big. I wouldn't figure in it. So that you actually think, now, who is very good at filming scorpions in Africa? And you know someone, a chap called Rod Borland in this particular instance. And you think, right, well, we'll send a letter to Rod, who's an old friend, and say, we want this sequence. You've got 3 years to do it in. Let us know when you got it. And altogether, over 20 different cameramen have actually taken part in the series, making the series.
So you're not there for all of it. It's not.
Wouldn't be possible. It would take. I worked it out the other day because so of the 20 cameramen, I would think about a dozen are working at any one time, and that's over 3 years. So it would take you 36 years to make a series if I was going to be there at all the time that the cameras were turning.
Yeah, the jungle would probably be paved over by then.
I feel you may be right.
Do you know, if you're writing before you get there, what you want to say, do you risk having already committed to certain things and being overwhelmed by something you didn't expect to be overwhelmed by?
Well, you shouldn't be overwhelmed by something. It's not that, as it were, it's not that kind of show. I don't mean that it isn't overwhelming. What I mean is that it deals with very important central facts about the desert. And if you've done your homework and if you are reasonably well experienced and you know what you're talking about, you ought to know what the central facts are about a desert. And your job is to illustrate that as vividly as you possibly can. So you do a lot of research, by talking to a lot of biologists who worked in deserts for a lot of time, and you come to the conclusion that the thing that would show it more powerfully than anything else is that. And that's what you go for.
Has it always worked out that you were right once you got there?
Yes, that's always worked out. I should think in between this series and the last series, there are only two animals doing things which I wanted, which I didn't get.
What?
Well, in Life on Earth, the one thing I wanted was a shot of a duck-billed platypus laying an egg, or the egg hatching and the young crawling out, which, as you know, it's a very primitive mammal. The young furry things coming out and suckling from sort of milky sweat which oozes from her fur. Now, nobody in the world has ever bred a duck-billed platypus in captivity. A pregnant one has been taken, but that's all. And I thought that would just be, and it would be, scientifically, a sensational shot. It happens in a burrow, and you know, it would have been very difficult. We actually offered a university scholarship, a research scholarship, to a zoologist, any zoologist in Australia, for a year, if they would do the research work necessary. And there were no takers, because everybody, all the zoologists in Australia, said it's too difficult, we couldn't do it. But that's the only, are the only things we found.
What's the other? You don't want to say?
Oh, yes, I can. There's a bird called the Satyr tragopan, which is, I think, one of the most spectacular pheasants in the Himalayas. Well, and one of the most spectacular birds in the world. And the display of a Satyr tragopan is simply mind-blowing. I can't begin to explain to you how astounding it is. I've seen it in captivity. And I wanted to get a Satyr tragopan displaying in the Himalayas wild in the first program, because I thought if that turns up within the first 5 minutes, everybody will be blown out of their mind. Well, we couldn't get it. We got some other pheasants. We got some very beautiful Impian pheasants, but we didn't get that one.
When you're a cameraman looking for animals to display, birds of display, its feathers or whatever, are you sitting there with the camera waiting and waiting, having it poised, ready to be turned on?
Well, of course, it's the sort of classic thing for the natural history cameraman to say modestly, well, I'm afraid we waited 9 months and 27 hours, whatever, you know, to get that shot. In point of fact, if the truth is to be told, the better cameraman you are and the better naturalist you are, the less time you have to wait. If you really know enough, you know, well, I mean, it's like turning up in England and hoping to get cuckoos in December. I mean, you know, they don't occur. Have cuckoos go cuckoo in spring, and so you turn up in spring. Well, if you really know, you know which week to turn up. And similarly, if you decide that you really want to have a monkey, the alpha male of a troop, displaying at a certain time, you find out the man who knows about that particular species and perhaps has been working with them for a year, and he'll say, oh, well, if that's what you want, I can take you, you want to meet Fred, who is the alpha male of group 3, and Fred always turns up in the morning about 5:30 with the troop on that log there just by the river, and he always sees Willie from the other side of the river, who is very fed up, and they're great rivals, and he always displays. And you go down there, and you get there 30 minutes before Fred's due, you set up the camera, Fred turns up, and he does it. And so you go away, and you say, fine, I've got the shot I wanted, and I did it in a day. But that is a measure of, not in this instance, in that instance, your success. It's the measure of the skill of the scientific observer who has spent his life studying that troop. And that's the fact of the matter. So that actually boasting how patient you were and how long it took you to get the shot is a kind of confession of inadequacy.
Hmm. Have any of your camera people ever gotten hurt or attacked by one of the animals who they'd come to shoot?
No, none of my friends, thank goodness, have ever had. I mean, we've all had the sort of mild occasions to climb a tree rather faster than one would think.
Are you good at that?
I've no idea whether I'm good. All I know is that when the rhinoceros charges, you find yourself 12 foot up a tree that has no branches beneath you, and you can't imagine how you got there. But actually, again, that again is a sort of the wrong kind of boast. If you're a good enough naturalist, you should know how close you can get to an elephant before it charges. You should be able to read the way it moves its ears, the way it shakes its head, and which way the wind is going, and so on, to know that is as close as you ought to get. And it's not my job or any of us our job to, in order to demonstrate to be brave. Our job is to get the pictures. And you don't actually get pictures by persuading an elephant to charge you and pound your camera to little bits of cogwheels into the dust.
Just curious, how close can you get to an elephant before he charges?
You can get, it depends on the wind.
On the wind?
Yeah, I don't mean the elephant's wind. I mean,
what does the wind have to do with it?
Well, because of your smell.
Oh.
I mean, if the wind suddenly, what you do if you want to get close to elephants, which isn't a particular ambition of mine, though I've spent a certain amount of time close to them, you get one of your silk stockings or nylon stockings and you put talcum powder in it. Face powder, and you hold it in a little bag, and you continually bob it up and down so that you can see from the way this very fine talcum powder is drifting, which way this is less than a wind. This is just the faintest breath of air. As long as the talcum powder keeps coming towards you, which is how you should have been approaching the elephant in the first place, that's okay. You're smelling the elephant, he's not smelling you. But if that talcum powder starts to move away from you, then you can bet your bottom dollar that the elephant is going to smell you quite soon, and this is the time you ought to retreat.
So the elephant's not really paying attention to seeing you, smelling
it doesn't
you.
It doesn't like the smell of human beings. Its eyesight's not all that good. It has very small eyes. And, of course, one on either side of its head, as it were, so it's viewing from the side all the time. And it is smell and sound which particularly get it upset.
You've been making naturalist movies for over 30 years. Film technology has changed a lot during that time. Is what you're able to show us different because of how the technology has changed?
It's changed beyond recognition. The first films I made back in 1952 in Africa, we had a clockwork camera. I mean, you had to wind it up. And it only ran for about, I think, 40 seconds or something. That was the longest shot you could take. There was no way in which you could actually record sound at the same time, synchronously. The lenses were small focal lengths so that you could really not get any decent close-ups. Without, that is, getting much closer than you would wish to be. The film stocks were extremely slow so that you couldn't actually film unless the light was very bright. You couldn't film in the jungle, for example. You couldn't film colour, certainly. It was just not enough light. Now, of course, you have cameras with marvellous lenses, very sensitive stocks, very fast lenses, very long focus lenses, so that you can do, with the cameras, all kinds of things which you couldn't do before. You can get resolution, definition of your picture much better than it was. But also, there are many other sort of things you can do. Recently, I mean, in the last, For Life on Earth, for example, we wanted to show a mole running down its tunnel. Nobody had ever shown a mole running down its tunnel. Perhaps nobody had ever wanted to show a mole running down its tunnel. But we decided we did. And so we went to the local hospital and borrowed their fibre optics, you know, which they know they use to put down people's throats and look inside their stomachs or inside their lungs. And we used that fibre optic device to put it in a mole's tunnel. Now, fibre optics are a relatively recent invention. In absolute darkness, you want to film in caves, you can use a thing called a light intensifier. Actually, you can't film it in the deepest caves, even with a light intensifier. But if you can use it in very overcast conditions, in moonlight, for example, or just in the mouth of the cave, where there's enough light to filter in, this is an electronic device, which actually was, I regret to say, developed by the military in order for people to look at night, at people moving. And you can see and you can film.
Do you watch your rushes right away?
Well, you can't watch them right away if you're in the middle of the Antarctic or in Brazil or wherever. You send them back whenever you can, just because it's as good to get them out of the way. You know, you don't want to be dragging them about too much.
Will you leave the Antarctic without being absolutely sure that the stuff that you shot came out well?
Oh, yeah.
You will leave?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, you have to. And it isn't, to be honest, it is not, this again, this sounds boastful, really. and though it's not boastful on my behalf because I'm not the cameraman, but the cameraman knows. I mean, a really professional cameraman knows whether this stuff's all right or not. The much, much more tricky thing is whether, in fact, the film has got lost on the way, whether somebody has stolen it, particularly in the far-flung part of, you know, where air communications are not as good as all that and where baggage gets lost fairly frequently. That's the worry. Thank goodness. We did have some material stolen, sorry to say, in Los Angeles. And it was some underwater material of whales and one thing or another. And we were absolutely mortified. It was stolen out of the car. And the police got it back for us. But that's the worst we've come to.
Did you camp out in most of the places?
In some.
Are there hotels, Jungle Hiltons or Antarctica Hiltons?
Well, again, I have a saying that any damn fool can be uncomfortable. If there's a decent hotel, I'll stay in a hotel. But there aren't decent hotels in a lot of places. So we will take a sheet of plastic and sleep under plastic sheeting for maybe a week, 2 weeks. But it's not again. If you're making a film, you require to have your gear in good position. It doesn't do any good to say, oh boy, were we tough, did we rough it, and there's fungus all over the lenses, you know, and we've condensation all over the film, and it's terrible, scratchy old stuff. But we were tough. That doesn't cut any ice. What you have to do is very professional, and so that if you can get a place where you can keep the gear clean, which is very important, then you will.
If you don't mind my asking, usually before you go on TV, someone applies makeup, you look yourself in the mirror, make sure your hair is all in place, right? How did you handle that when you're up in the Himalayas?
I think you might suggest that my hair wasn't actually always in place. No, we don't have... Well, that's a good idea. Maybe I should suggest we take a makeup girl, but it isn't actually the way it works. Neither do we have teleprompters or any of those sort of things.
So you just didn't concern yourself with that?
That's of no consequence, really.
Did you ever feel just a little bit funny doing a stand-up in the middle of the mountains or in the middle of the jungles?
Yeah, you feel pretty silly doing that. Well, I suppose not really, because you're a group. And you're, in a sort of sociological terms, you're a little in-group and you all understand your own conventions, you know where you are. And the local people think you're balmy anyway. I mean, what are you sort of putting your eye to this little black box for and jumping up and down?
Well, I guess it's David Attenborough, if you're just joining us. You really exposed yourself to some of the most hostile and some of the most beautiful parts of the world. Did you find yourself alternately feeling, oh, nature is benevolent and nature is hostile?
Oh, nature's not nature's not universally benevolent by any manner of means. I mean, you've only got to go to the Antarctic to know that nature is simply not benevolent, at least not benevolent to Homo sapiens. She may be quite benevolent to penguins, but she's not to you. And actually, she's not all that benevolent to penguins. I mean, penguins have a pretty rough time. They live in the most hostile part of the world, really. I mean, emperor penguins nesting in the middle of on the ice shelf regularly lose a major proportion, well, a substantial proportion of their population every year. They're just killed by the blizzards and the cold. So that, and you know perfectly well that if you just fell in the water, you would die within 2 minutes. From the cold, you would be no way of recovery. So it is not a benevolent place. But equally, actually, the jungle is not all that benevolent. The interesting thing, I think, from the point of view of humanity, I don't actually think it is an accident that civilization started in a part of the world where it was neither too hot nor too cold. I also have a private theory. It started in the part of the world where the vine grew particularly well. It does actually seem to me that it's no accident that the vine and the grape coincides very closely with the most important parts of civilization. Certainly, that's a place where I regard as nature as being benevolent. The Mediterranean, you know what I mean? Just California. Great. And I suspect that to have the beaded cup in front of you while you drink and talk about life has played a major part in the growth of civilization.
This is a theory I could really get behind. Do you take things like wine with you when you're traveling?
Oh, I do if it's there. You can't take wine. I think that one of the facilities that you have to develop if you are going to be to make these kind of films is a capacity to distinguish between having a gastronomic meal and taking in food, taking in fuel, that is. We reckon to eat whatever anybody else who happens to live there eats. And sometimes it's fairly unpleasant, in which case you just turn your mind to higher things as you chew through this appalling stuff and swallow it because you know you've got to.
Were there any places that you went to that you felt, man doesn't really belong here? I mean, I'm here, I want to show everybody what this is like, but this place was not meant for people.
Well, the Antarctic that I was just speaking of is certainly a place that was not really meant for people, or it wasn't meant for people, using that phrase in inverted commas. And that certainly is. And so the High Himalayas is a very hostile place. And you can demonstrate that. I mean, this isn't just subjective, it is objective. The fact is that in the highest altitudes, the air is so thin that women are not able to take in enough oxygen with each breath to feed both themselves and a large unborn babe. So that women can't bear children at the highest altitudes.
When you were speaking on camera from the Himalayas, it sounded like you were a little short of breath. I'm not sure if that was from hiking or just from the lack of oxygen.
Well, I must make a confession. The point of that sequence was to show that as you move from the lowest altitudes to the highest altitudes, the air got thinner, and that men had adapted as well as animals had, and that the Sherpas who live at the high altitude have very much bigger chests and very much bigger lungs, and actually have a slightly different capacity in their blood to carry oxygen, and they're very much better than Europeans. So in order to demonstrate that man, too, was adaptable to circumstances, I had to make it clear that I was finding hard to breathe. Now, maybe I hammed it up more than I should have. I'm not even sure that I was hamming it up, but I was certainly not disguising the fact that I was short of breath. So when this was shown in Britain, the press, God bless them, wrote and said, you know, it really is unfair of the BBC to send this poor old guy, you know. I mean, he's worked loyally for them for 30 years, and what do? They send the poor old thing up these high altitudes, and it's criminal, really. I was furious.
That's really funny. Did you write letters to them explaining?
No, I just looked hurt.
I didn't want to make it seem like you were like heaving and panting,
but
you could just hear that you. I assumed it was because of the altitude.
Well, you're quite right. I'm glad you are more perceptive than my pals in the press.
No letters. I didn't write them anything. You spent some time in the deserts and in the jungles for the series, and I know that the jungles are especially in the Amazon are getting built up slowly. Do you find the same thing happening with the deserts too? How concerned are you now about urbanization and encroaching on jungles and deserts?
Well, I'm deeply concerned. I'm an international trustee of the World Wildlife Fund, and I've been involved in conservation movement for a quarter of a century, I suppose. They're different problems, of course. The jungle and the desert are two different problems. The jungle is in danger because we are knocking it down for very short-term profit. Very short-term profit. In some cases, a profit of like 3 years, in which you can actually cultivate cassava or something on the land that you've cleaned before it becomes sterile. In some cases, just in order for the one-time profit of turning 200-year-old trees into fiber for paper, which you're going to throw away. That's one kind of catastrophe. The other kind of catastrophe, which is the one that's in the Sahel, the area immediately south of the Sahara, just at the moment in Ethiopia, and indeed right across Africa, is that, of course, there are too many people trying to get a living out of that very, very poor land, so that if there is a slight variation in the climate, and there's actually been more than a slight variation in Africa, it's dried out. The desert now is advancing very fast south, and the people are, simply by their presence there, are speeding that advance, because they are having to cook food for their starving children, and there is a bush and it has some branches, and that's what you need to burn in order to cook it. And the fact that if you cut that bush down will mean that the roots no longer hold the land, the grass together, so that in fact the desert speeds up its advance even quicker, is of no consequence to you if you have to feed your starving child. So that, in fact, the desert is advancing very fast and the people are starving.
What are the chances that wildlife would adapt to the kind of changes that development brings?
Well, wildlife does adapt to some changes, but it adapts in the short term by existing populations and existing kinds of animals moving in. In the case of the Sahel, or the Sahara, of course, what is happening is that the grassland animals, which did live there, are being driven out, and desert living animals are moving in, but much fewer of them, because the desert supports much fewer animals than the grassland. In cities, of course, there are actually animals which are adapting to the city circumstance to an extraordinary degree. For example, there are whole populations of mice that live in cold stores which have developed thicker fur than mice outside. And from all accounts, actually, genetically so. I mean, that is to say that even if you took those mice out of the cold store, their young would still have thicker fur. Equally, there are kinds of insects which are adapting to live on the particular circumstances that we create in cities. There's a type of cockroach that lives on almost nothing else than the plastic coating of insulating wires, so it lives inside a television set, slowly chewing its way through the insulation.
Is that really true?
Yes. Yes, it's really true.
My goodness! What are some of the other specialties of cockroaches? This is very alarming.
Well, this is a particular sort, but cockroaches, by and large, have an extraordinary capacity to eat the most uneatable things, as it were. Just as the termites would eat solid wood that you would suppose is of no nutritive value at all, but they can extract some.
What kind of posture do you take toward the cockroach? Because on the one hand, it's just like, tribute to the ability of life to adapt to its environment. On the other hand, it's a real pest for people.
Sure. Well, I mean, I am not one of those conservationists who says that we have no moral right to kill anything. If I did, I would have to be a vegetarian. I'm not. I mean, I eat a steak just like anybody else eats a steak. And equally, I don't think that I would welcome rats overrunning my house or my larder. I believe that man is a part of nature, and his original role was that he was an omnivore and he was perfectly, therefore, unable to hunt. What I think is intolerable is if people actually kill things for the thrill of killing things, or if people inflict cruelty on things needlessly and willfully, or if they kill things for trivial reasons, or if, and above all, I feel very powerfully about this, they kill them on such a wholesale way that they endanger the species so that one kind of creature has disappeared from the world forever. Those seem to me to be the important things. And within those context, within those parameters, then I think man actually being the most powerful of all organizations has an obligation to manage the world.
Has saying the predatory instincts of animals in the wild made you more comfortable also with man's place in eating meat? And
yes, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I, the structure of our bodies, of our teeth, of our gut, lead me to suppose that man biologically is an omnivore, that man biologically ate meat. And I think that is, therefore, I don't have particular qualms. Now, I have to say that I'm sufficiently divorced from the real world, that if I had to actually kill everything I ate, perhaps I wouldn't.
Since we're on the subject of predatory instincts, sex and violence is such a big issue in television programming. How much of sex, parentheses, mating, or violence, parentheses, one animal killing another for its food, do you think it's proper to show for a documentary series on television?
Well, the curious thing is that if you show one sequence of copulation, it may last. I mean, in terms of actual technical of when it starts and when it finishes, no more than about, say, perhaps, let us say, for the sake of argument, a minute and a half. People will be convinced afterwards that the program showed nothing else. I mean, they'll say that program. I mean, why you went on and on and on and on about that sequence? We can't possibly understand. It was really awful of you. And that of course is because these images are so powerful that hit us subliminally and psychologically so powerfully that we are knocked right off balance by them. I, as you say, I used to be a film director. I used to be a director of programs, and I remember very well. We have a fairly liberal view about those sort of scenes that you can do. But on the other hand, we had a financial program, which was devoted to doing an item about bloodstock and horses and the value in terms of economics of what thoroughbred stock was and so on. And they had an interview in which a man was talking to a breeder about this. And over the breeder's shoulder in the background, there was a stallion servicing a mare. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with stallions servicing mares, but I can tell you it's a fairly spectacular proceeding. And I was as mad as anything as the network director that the irresponsibility of doing that, because actually it was totally irrelevant. I mean, of course, he thought it was quite, and the producer thought it was quite entertaining because it was marginally, peripherally appropriate. But it was not centrally appropriate. And it was not about the economics. And the result, but the image was so powerful that nobody could possibly listen to about the economics while this extraordinary drama was going on behind. Now, that seems to me irresponsible and totally indefensible. But if you were doing a program about the nature of display or the techniques that a scorpion had, it being a very antique organism, and how, in fact, the evolution of sexual behaviours developed amongst that group of invertebrate animals, then it seems to me totally proper that you should do it. Of course, you can be lascivious about it, just as you can be lascivious and obscene about violence, and you can use shots of lions tearing the entrails from some poor wildebeest. I mean, it happens. You didn't organise it. There it is. But is it what the program's about? I mean, is it necessary for it to be an accurate truth? If you actually sanitise it so that you never put any of that in, that's just as bad, because that gives a totally misleading idea as to what the world of nature is like.
Do people get more concerned about mating, the animals mating on camera, if the animals are closer to humans? In other words, like,
oh, yes.
Not fish, but
sure.
Two-legged or four-legged?
Oh, absolutely so, of course, as you might imagine. And I would suppose, I was going to say, I would suppose that only Homo sapiens is the one who has not been displayed, but even that, I suppose, has been displayed fairly explicitly.
Yes. My guest is David Attenborough. Did you grow up in the city?
In a town, yeah. Well, it was a city, yes. But one that I could get to the country fairly easily on a bicycle.
Yeah, because I was kind of wondering how you became as comfortable with different physical environments, because I think a lot of people who grew up in the city adapt less easily to exotic locations and climates.
I'm not sure that's true, actually. I think a lot of us who grew up in cities developed a great hunger for these kind of places.
Mm.
A sufficient hunger to kind of quell the uncomfortableness of involved in going there. I grew up. I certainly spent a lot of time in the countryside looking for fossils or hedgehogs or whatever. But I was certainly a city boy.
When did you start studying zoology?
I suppose I've been doing it as long as I can remember. I've always from as a kid, keeping salamanders and snakes and one thing or another, and I've never stopped doing that. As a matter of fact, I for the very first time in my life, this 2 years ago, I got rid of a fish tank. I'd had a fish tank as long as I could remember, and I got rid of it this time because we had some alterations in the house, and my kids are in their 30s, and so you don't keep them for the kids. You give yourself excuses for keeping fish, but I shouldn't really. I should go back to it, I'm sure.
When did you decide that you weren't going to live the academic life and write textbooks, but instead you were going to write popular books and make movies that a popular audience could appreciate?
Well, when I was an undergraduate studying zoology, it sounds amazing now to say this, but it is true, and this was in Cambridge in 1944-45. The kind of zoology that we learnt was a zoology which was laboratory-based. Most of the animals you dealt with were dead. You were cutting them up to learn about their anatomy. Or if you were studying live animals, behaving, as it were, then there were rats running through mazes or frogs jumping in front of a checkered board or something. What you didn't do was to go out and look at exciting animals like elephants or lions in Africa. That was not zoology. That was either big game hunting or natural history or something. But it certainly wasn't science, because you couldn't. It was kind of thought that science involved manipulating in an experimental way the animals you were studying. But unbeknownst to me at that time, the great pioneers of animal behavioral studies, Conrad Lorenz, for example, were actually working on this behavioral science that we now call ethology. But I was then called up and I went to the Navy. And when I came out of the Navy, it still seemed that they were still cutting up dogfish and watching mice in mazes. And I thought, well, this is not for me. And I went into publishing and then got into the BBC and persuaded them to let me make animal films.
Did they reach an audience right away?
Yes. Animal films have always had a huge audience, in Britain at any rate, and I suspect here. I really think that people, and I'm with them, think that there are few things more beautiful than a butterfly or a hummingbird, and that there's few things more dramatic than a party of warrior ants invading termites. There are few things more extraordinary than some of the breeding techniques of amphibians, and so on. And it's always had a huge audience.
You think it's the beauty of it?
No, I think it's all those things: the beauty, the drama, the fascination, the unexpectedness, the uninhibitedness, the truth in a curious way. I mean, animals don't lie to suit the camera, as it were. What they do is what they do. They may lie to one another. In fact, they do. But they don't lie to the camera.
Do you ever find yourself, though, doing the equivalent of only looking to photograph pretty people, you know, like looking to photograph animals who are especially photogenic or landscapes that are especially dramatic or beautiful?
That, in fact, is one of the reasons why I determined to do those two series, Life on Earth and Living Planet, because there's a great temptation, as you say, to do the pretty ones all the time. I know perfectly well how you can get a very good, an enormously popular program. If you want an enormously popular animal program, it's not difficult. You might just put a chimpanzee in it.
It's the equivalent of having an infant.
That's right. Right. Uh-huh. If you want to make an unpopular program, you put a snake in it. Now, if you, on the other hand, you say, I wish to survey the animal kingdom, you have to do programs about snakes and chimpanzees. And so you have to do programs entirely about insects, which are not all that pleasant. I remember starting Life on Earth because I said we've got to start at the very beginning and go from the beginning of life all the way through. The first program was going to be almost entirely about algae and single-celled organisms, you see. And I was trying to sell this to a television executive to make sure that they get some money, a decent budget for this. And he said, the first program is of great importance. You know, that's what the audience is going to judge it on. So what's your first program going to be? And I told him it was going to be about this. And he said, how the hell, he said, are you going to get 10,000 people grabbed by the throat by green slime, he said, which indeed is a question. Making programs about green slime is not as easy as making about chimpanzees. But if you're going to be comprehensive and responsible, you should try and do so.
Did you keep that as the first show?
Oh, yes.
And did it work?
Did
you get the audience?
Yes, it did, fortunately.
What do you think you did with that made it so compelling? I think it's a pretty interesting subject
myself. Yeah, so do I. Yeah. Well, I do too. And I suppose it is because you and I both think it is that we would have managed to have made it interesting. I mean, that's the skill. I can't imagine that one would ever be able to make an interesting program about a subject which you actually found dull. As far as the Life on Earth first program was concerned, we gilded the lily a bit by starting initially in the Galapagos Islands and talking about the nature of evolution and why things move, before we moved to the green slime. But the green slime occupied about 50-60% of that program.
My guest is David Attenborough, and he is the creator, writer, and host of the series Life on Earth and of the new series The Living Planet. There was a kind of a wildlife program that was, I think, especially popular in the 50s, which is having a bit of a comeback in America now, the wild safari-type program where somebody goes off with their binoculars in search of the wildebeest or whatever and tracks them down and shows them up, and that's the program. What do you think of programs like that?
Oh, that's fine. I made hundreds of them. In fact, that was what one used to make. In the early days. I mean, in the 50s, it would be a cameraman and me. I mean, it would be a close friend, a cameraman. The two of us would go to Borneo for 4 months, and we would just go into the jungle and disappear, and we would film whatever turned up. And when the green-vented bulbul turned up and you got the shot, you then actually sort of filmed a sequence which you explained that the only reason you had come to the Borneo was in order to film the green-vented bulbul. And you used to think, oh, we must be able to get something for a series out of that. And that's fine, because it actually is about real natural history, in a sense. I mean, it's about real adventure, and it's about real people. And the audience identifies with going on that particular trip and making those discoveries. And so I'm all for those programs. Of course, they can be faked quite easily. Not only just with the green-vented bulbul. I mean, there have been cases of people who actually buy other people's films and stick them in and pretend it's part of their adventure. But I would be, nonetheless, I think they're okay programs. And as I say, I've made more lots and lots and lots in my time. The Life on Earth and Living Planet are different kinds of programs in which there is a more carefully thought out central theme, which tries to explain something in a way that you couldn't possibly do if you just went in there and shot whatever happened to move.
It's not the show and tell approach.
No. It's what?
It's not the show and tell approach. I mean, you're trying to give a sense of ecological systems and history.
That's right. And so that's why when you we wrote the whole series before we started in very, very considerable detail, so that we knew exactly what we wanted. And when you go, you don't say, oh, here's something I've never seen before, and it's doesn't really involve what I'm talking about, but it is interesting, isn't it? You have to eschew that kind of thing. But I think if I look at the programs that I do, and say what's wrong with them, which you must do, I would say that what was wrong with my programs is that if anything is too much in them, there are too many. They're overrich. There are too many plums in that particular pudding. And that's the temptation. The temptation is that the jungle is so rich, or the deserts are so rich, that you want to put everything in. And the skill is actually leaving it out, not putting it in.
Is there a desired response you'd like viewers to have to your programs?
Well, if I'm totally honest, I have to say that the reason I make these kind of programs is because I find the subject matter fascinating. And therefore find it very enjoyable. There's nothing I enjoy more than watching animals doing things. And I would hope that other people would enjoy them. That's the primary thing. Now, of course, if you think that the wildlife and animals and plants are enjoyable and important, and somebody says they are in danger, then you have a sort of obligation to make sure that you can do what you can to help them and protect them. And so I am delighted if a subsidiary purpose or subsidiary effect of these films is that people also say, not only is this wonderful and marvelous to look at, but it is valuable, it is threatened, and therefore we must do something to make sure that it's not destroyed, then I'm delighted.
Your brother is also a famous filmmaker, Richard Attenborough, who made the film Gandhi. Are you close with each other?
Yes, we live within a mile of one another at home in London, and we see one another a lot.
Are you each surprised at how the other has turned out and the kind of work that you've accomplished?
Yes, I am. I find him quite extraordinary. I couldn't possibly do what he does. I mean, you say he made Gandhi, which indeed he did. The idea of trying to control a crowd of 200,000 people would drive me bananas. I mean, I couldn't. It's just kind of nightmare that would be. Equally, I think that he wouldn't be regarding himself in paradise if he was sitting with gorillas. But I mean, there you are.
Do you think of yourselves as being similar in the work that you do, or different?
I think we've probably both got the gift of the gab, if you know what I mean. I think. I mean, if I'm to be honest, I suppose that we both aren't lost for words. But I would have thought that's about all. Certainly, the techniques you need to be a great theatre director and a great film director in the dramatic sense, which I think he is, those skills are quite opposite, almost opposite, and certainly very different from the skills that you need to make natural history films. By and large, actors get better the more you get them to repeat what they're doing. By and large, animals get worse the more you repeat, trying to persuade them to repeat what they do.
I guess you don't really have much of a choice either. You probably can't persuade them
to repeat. I mean, there is a crucial moment in which something's going to happen, and you have to get it then. It's no good saying, I'm awfully sorry, lads, I wasn't ready, you know, would you go back to the roost, please, fruit bats, and we'll take off again. That doesn't work, and you have to. So it's a very, very different kind of approach. But it also happens with human beings that if you are filming, let us say, Indians, and Indians are doing a ritual, or there's a marriage, or whatever it is. There is a way in which you put the cameras and the way in which you handle it, which you've got to do, which you certainly wouldn't do if you were filming dramatically. But if you then said, well, I'm sorry, I'd now like you to repeat the thing, even though they were trying to do it as honestly as they can, they become normal people, very stilted if they repeat actions or forced to. Actors are not normal people. I mean, they're special people, and they have that special ability to repeat it. And that's what the great film director knows how to handle.
Do you and your brother see each other's work?
At work.
No, do you see each other's work?
Oh, we see each other's work. Oh, yes. I get all his premieres.
Do you give each other feedback on it, or is that too sensitive?
Yes, you do. You certainly give more feedback than you do to anybody else in the same field. I mean, I'm being slightly guarded, because the fact of the matter is that if you work for 3 years on a major project, and it is now being exposed to the gaze of the public for the very first time, you are extraordinarily and unbelievably vulnerable. And if you're fond of somebody, you don't actually lump in and say, well, that was a catastrophe, wasn't it? My God, I can't imagine why you did such and such and so and so. You say it was all wonderful. Maybe perhaps there was a little bit at the end which was perhaps just marginally less wonderful. But then, you know, the months go by, and then you'll be sitting having a drink or whatever together and say, I don't know, Dick, I think that bit there was, and you might well say the same thing to me.